Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a former Undersecretary of State and Ambassador to NATO makes the case for a strong U.S. leadership to pull the world through the pandemic. Our guest this hour is Nicholas Burns, who says while the U.S. should be organizing members of the G20 to coordinate on medical and economic responses to COVID-19, the Trump administration so far has remained somewhat disengaged from global efforts, and that the president's inclinations to divide rather than unite the country might be counterproductive to domestic efforts. To be clear, Burns also says it's not too late for the U.S. to step into a leading role. We'll talk to him about what that might look like after a short break. Is pretty much everywhere, in megacities and tiny towns, in 210 countries and territories around the world. A pandemic crisis calls for global leadership to rally the nations of the world to work together to defeat an unseen and highly destructive enemy. Should the U.S. be taking the reins on this? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Ambassador Nicholas Burns served as U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 2005 to 2008 and as U.S. Ambassador to NATO from 2001 to 2005. Currently, he's Professor of Diplomacy and International Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he recently published an essay in Foreign Affairs magazine called How to Lead in a Time of Pandemic. In it, he notes that President Trump has been especially disengaged from international leadership in recent weeks at precisely the time when coordination and collaboration are essential to tackle health and economic conditions that have spread to virtually every place on Earth. He joins us now to talk about that. Ambassador Burns, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris. Glad to be with you.
You say COVID-19 could have an impact as severe as a world war. What do you mean by that?
Well, the fact that every person on Earth is vulnerable to this virus, 7.7 billion people in every single country. And the consequences, we'll see how this pandemic goes. But right now, people like Bill Gates are predicting that 2/3 of the dead eventually will be in the developing world. So that's ahead of us. What will be the impact on India, on South Africa, on Nigeria, on Brazil, on Argentina, as well as on China, Europe, and the United States? We've been in the first part of this. So it's universal. Every single person is vulnerable, feeling, I think, anxious about it. And collectively, the pandemic has thrown us into a global economic, a deep recession, which could possibly turn into a depression. Let's pray and hope that it doesn't. But that's the second concomitant challenge here. And I think together, these two challenges probably represent the greatest threat to us since the Second World War. It's going to require real leadership. And in America, we have to pull together across party lines to defeat the pandemic and obviously to try to revive our economy when that time comes.
What are the limits to what the WHO can do?
Well, the World Health Organization has been the central place where public health specialists and epidemiologists, what they try to do is share data so they can model and track diseases like the coronavirus, and they can then have predictive capacity to try to tell countries well ahead of time, you know, get ready, the pandemic's coming. Batten down the hatches, self-isolate, do the kind of things that we've all had to do here in the United States. If you're sharing the data accurately, then, of course, you can warn countries ahead of time. One of the problems that we've had in these 4 months of the pandemic has been that China did not share a lot of data well and easily in the crucial first months of December, January, into February. And that left particularly some of the countries that were next hit in Western Europe. You saw the tragedies develop in Italy and Spain. That left us also vulnerable here in the United States. You've also got to listen to public health experts and not allow politics to intrude. And that's been a problem not just in the United States. It's been a problem in several countries, in Britain, in Sweden, as well as the United States, where politicians figure, you know, I'm going to make this call as to when we shut down the school system of Dallas, Texas, for instance. And when I'm not, well, that's ultimately the mayor's or Mayor Eric Johnson's decision in Dallas, someone I admire, or it's the governor's decision. But it's got to be made listening to public health experts. That's why the World Health Organization is very important. It's the one place in the world where all this comes together.
If China needs to be a significant partner in this, simply given its population and its footprint in the world, what do we do about the fact that it's not just the United States that can't necessarily trust health information coming out of China? It's every country in the world.
That's right. Well, it's to try to pressure China, and in a case, shame China into making sure that it does share the information with us. China has done better since then. China has tried very hard to be responsive. Now that the virus is in the past in China, at least the first wave, people have gone back to work in Wuhan and Hubei province. They're back in Shanghai and Beijing. So the Chinese are now exporting N95 masks all around the world and ventilators. And they're trying to show that they're a good global citizen. The problem, of course, in China is that there's an authoritarian government. And that government does not have a history of telling truth to its own people, much less the people in the world. And so I think the Chinese are worried. They're worried when they hear Italians and Spaniards and Dutch and Germans criticizing them over the quality of some of this humanitarian aid and reliability of some of the aid that's arrived. I think they're very sensitive to how the American press and how the American government, how President Trump talks about them. So there are pressure points here where we can try to motivate the Chinese government to do better. But frankly, you know the old biblical adage about living in a glass house and throwing stones. We in the United States have a lot to learn from others too. We have not done well in protecting our own citizens. I don't mean to just focus on President Trump here either. This is public health in our country is a local and state responsibility. Some states have done better than others. It looks in these early days, because they are early days, unfortunately, that California and Oregon and Washington have done relatively better. Gavin Newsom of California basically shut down the Bay Area sooner than my state of Massachusetts shut down, or New York State did, or Illinois. And so, or Texas. And so I think, at the end of this, it's probably not the right time to do it now. I hope that the president and Democrats and Republicans in Congress will form a 9/11 type commission, of a bipartisan commission of citizens who will try to decide what went wrong, what went right, so that we don't repeat these mistakes, so our doctors and nurses have the right equipment the next time a pandemic hits. And it will hit because, as you know, Chris, we've had the SARS virus in 2003, H1N1 in 2009, Ebola in 2014, and now the coronavirus in 2020. We're going to have to live with pandemics in the future, which means we have to be better at surviving them.
In my introduction, I quoted you calling the president especially disengaged from the COVID-19 crisis. I want to note for our audience that you published that piece on March 25th. Is that still true almost 3 weeks later?
Unfortunately, it is. And here, Chris, I want to make one point clear up front, which I try to do in my article. The president's first responsibility is to the American public. It's to all of our states. And that's the responsibility that all of us have, to give unstinting support to the doctors, nurses, hospital staff, the real heroes here. We've seen them so courageous on the front lines. And that's where the president's attention has been. So I'm not criticizing him for paying more attention to the United States and the rest of the world. He should pay attention more to the United States than he is. But as we focus at home, there's got to be an international dimension, because especially the biggest economies with capacity, they have to work on a vaccine together and decide how to distribute several billion doses of that vaccine on an equitable basis. There are real questions about the efficacy of the World Health Organization. You asked me about it. How do we strengthen that organization? How do we share data together? How do we prepare for a second wave of coronavirus and prepare for a next pandemic? That's a global agenda too. And here I do think, respectfully, the president's been deficient. The United States is still the world leader. We're still the wealthiest country. We're certainly the most powerful country economically and militarily and politically, and yet we've not led at all. And there are ways to lead. Back in 2008, when the Great Recession hit, President George W. Bush, he convened the G20. This is a group of the 20 most powerful economies in the world. And they all worked together to align their policies to try to stem that great crisis. And I think President Trump ought to be doing that. He ought to be reaching out to the Chinese and the Russians and the Japanese and the Indians and trying to align our policies so that we're all pulling on the same oar. Right now, that's not happening. And frankly, without the leadership of the United States, it's unlikely to happen.
So the G20 has obviously 19 other member states. As of this morning, we have 555,000 diagnosed cases of COVID-19 in the U.S., which is far more than any other country in the world. Why is it incumbent on the U.S. to take the lead on coordinating a G20 response?
Well, we shouldn't put it all on our shoulders. And it's not like we're the only country that can participate. Others look to us for leadership. Right now, the chair rotates of the G20 countries is Saudi Arabia, a very close friend of the United States, the crown prince there, Mohammed bin Salman, who's been so much in the news, very controversial. He's not going to try to lead this parade without the express permission and urging of Donald Trump. They're close political partners in international politics. I think if the Chinese and Americans decided to lead, then it would happen. That's been difficult because through most of the pandemic, most of the last couple of months, there's been a war of words between Beijing and Washington. The Chinese, as you know, they came out with this preposterous, completely baseless claim that the Wuhan virus was planted in Wuhan by the U.S. Army, which is, of course, baseless. We then say, well, we started calling it, we meaning the president, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, started calling the virus the Wuhan or the Chinese virus, basically saying that China was solely responsible for this. We're all in the same boat, all these countries around the world. And if China and the United States would want to lead, I think they could pull in a lot of support from some of the other powerful countries in the world who have a lot to contribute. And some of it is contributing funds to help the poorer countries. But for the most part, this is self-interest. This is in the interest of American citizens to have us share the data better and more efficiently, prepare for the next pandemic, and search for a vaccine. By acting globally, we're actually helping Americans at home.
The president has been giving daily news conferences for the past several weeks. What stands out to you from those appearances?
Well, you know, I'm sorry to say, and I've got to be transparent to your audience, I am someone who's supporting Joe Biden for president, so I think people need to know that about me so they can, you know, just know that that's where I'm coming from. But I try to be fair to the president, at least. He is our president. I think, you know, there have been times when the president has been effective in warning Americans of the danger ahead. 2 weeks ago, you remember when we had these terrible predictions that between 150 and 240,000 Americans might die. I remember a press conference where the president was sober and advising people to stay at home, and I thought that was positive. On the other hand, I think for the most part, he has used these press conferences really to be vindictive politically, to cast aspersions on his political opponents. I mean, attacking Governor Whitmer of Michigan, I thought was really a shame to see an American president in a national crisis resort to partisan politics. I think these governors all need to work with him and want to work with him. And in the past, we've seen leaders do well. I'm thinking of George W. Bush after 9/11, when he speaks for the whole country and speaks to the whole country, regardless of party. Certainly that's how FDR got us through the Great Depression and conducted the Second World War. That's how Lincoln, our greatest president, was able to lead us through our most horrible conflict, the Civil War, by being above all that and appealing that to everyone that we're one nation. And I think President Trump too often has been speaking to his own party and his own followers, but not to the rest of America. And that's a big group of people.
Setting aside for a moment the needs of the rest of the world and whatever moral obligation we might have as Americans to serve those needs, can an America First strategy work for this country in the context of something like a pandemic?
I don't think it can. And that's one of the reasons why I have not supported the president respectfully, is that his view essentially is that the United States can afford to be on its own, doesn't really need our allies and partnerships around the world. And that America acting alone is a stronger country because we're not encumbered by others. That would have been a perfectly logical position for a different type of America. America, say, in the 19th century, we didn't depend on trade. We didn't live in a globalized world where we're so connected, where so many of our jobs in America, one of every six or seven jobs depends on exports, farm jobs. I know that, you know, your station is in 10 states. A lot of them are farm states. Our farm economy can't exist without a reliance on trade with others. So I think that's where the president's gone wrong. And frankly, you can't be successful in a pandemic unless you are thinking international as well as national.
My guest is Ambassador Nicholas Burns. We're talking about his foreign affairs essay, How to Lead in a Time of Pandemic. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Ambassador Nicholas Burns, who is professor of diplomacy and international relations at the Harvard Kennedy School and was U.S. ambassador to NATO from 2001 to 2005 and U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 2005 to 2008. You note, Ambassador Burns, that the president rarely mentions collaborations with global allies with regard to COVID-19. Is there any indication that it's happening anyway between the State Department and FEMA and other agencies with their counterparts abroad? The president may not be talking about it, but perhaps it's happening in a pretty robust way.
I think international cooperation is happening really well between the public, among the public health experts, the epidemiologists around the world. They have an existing forum in the World Health Organization. It's not happening as well at the presidential or prime ministerial level. And actually, Chris, what I meant in part in writing that in Foreign Affairs, that particular passage, was that one of my students who is from Europe reminded me, he said, you know, a little bit of just attention from the American president goes a long way. If he even just spoke out about the suffering of people, this is when Italy was in the throes of it, before the big wave hit New York, a little human sympathy would go a long way because people look towards the American president for that kind of thing. And the president actually started doing that last week. He said, you know, I hope we get to the point where if infection rates are reduced in America, we might be able to lend ventilators to some of our neighboring countries, to Mexico and Canada. And I thought that was the right thing for him to say. I mean, obviously, we have to tend to our own sick first. But if we get to a point where America has survived this and we're on a better path, we do have a self-interest, as well as, you know, do the morally right thing to try to help our neighbors.
Was the United States caught any more off guard by this pandemic than other industrialized countries?
Well, it's interesting. The record's pretty mixed around the world. Clearly, the United States and Western Europe were caught off guard. We made decisions later in terms of shutting down schools and workplaces and going into lockdown. Some of the countries that reacted first were our democracies, South Korea and Taiwan, both democracies. They are, and also Singapore, not exactly a democracy, but a well-run city-state. These are all countries that went through SARS. And they went through H1N1. So in the last 20 years, this is the third big pandemic. It's really the first big pandemic that hit the United States. And those countries, those three that I mentioned in East Asia, they made decisions very quickly. They had very finely developed public health strategies. They had enough equipment in their hospitals. Now they're smaller than the United States. We're also a federal system. And so power is with the states, as it should be. On issues like public health. And I think one of the early lessons for us is that our social safety net's not strong enough here in America, that we need the government to be there to help people, especially poorer people, survive in a pandemic like this.
Did those other countries, did the United States rather respond more proactively to SARS and H1N1, or did those earlier pandemics simply get stopped before they arrived here?
We did suffer from, I remember, H1N1, and the Obama administration formed a task force on it. Americans did die during that pandemic, but not nearly in the numbers that we're seeing now. But the Asian countries were hit harder, and so they had more recent experience, and they were thus better prepared. And their mindset was highly attuned to the threat of pandemics. And that's, I think, the way Americans are going to need to be for the foreseeable future, given the way global health is proceeding.
Some of the president's detractors have noted his administration disbanded the National Security Council Directorate for Global Health and Security. Now, his defenders remind us that most of the jobs performed by that agency were, in fact, preserved. Can you give us some context on how important or unimportant it is that the agency itself exists?
Well, the Center for Disease Control is the center of public health in the United States in Atlanta. That obviously continues to this day, but its budget was cut under the Trump administration. But you referred, Chris, to this office in the National Security Council at the White House that President Bush and then President Obama had set up. is only a small group of people, but the White House is the center of power. And if you're at the center of power, and I served at the NSC staff for 5 years, back for H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, then you have access to the president. You have access to the rest of the cabinet. Your voice can be heard. And I think that was probably, in hindsight, that was the mistake that President Trump made, one that I think he should reverse now. You know, it's not enough just to criticize. We've got to, on the fly, we've got to strengthen ourselves. There ought to be a White House office that is focused on public health so that we can be better prepared and better organized.
My guest is Ambassador Nicholas Burns. He's professor of diplomacy and international relations at the Harvard Kennedy School. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. What do you make, Ambassador, of the recent reporting that reveals the president was receiving daily briefings on the spread of this virus, the severity of the infections starting in early January? What kinds of actions might he have taken in that moment that could have kept us from an outbreak that has now infected more than 500,000 Americans?
Right. If your listeners want to go to the source, it's the New York Times and Washington Post accounts over the weekend. Well, it appears, and it's pretty good documentary evidence, that the Health and Human Service Secretary, Alex Azar, was onto this crisis very early, in the early part of January, was warning the president there could be a possible pandemic. That's what the public health experts were saying to the president. But the president chose to put them off and relied on his own judgment. And that appears to have been a tragic mistake. One lesson for anybody who's not a public health expert is listen to them. On an issue like this, rely on them. Obviously, you know, we asked the president to use his or her judgment, his judgment in this case, to make these big decisions. And the president's had a doubly difficult task, and that is to decide what to do in the pandemic as it relates to the global, to the national economy. That makes it more difficult. But still, these articles, I think, testify that the president simply didn't listen hard enough to them or didn't trust his public health advisors. Clearly, if we had reacted earlier, lives could have been saved. The country would be better off. And I wish for the president, you referred earlier, Chris, to his daily press conferences. If I were advising him, I'd say, maybe, Mr. President, do one or two a week when you have something to say, an announcement to make. Let Dr. Anthony Fauci and Ambassador Susan Burks and the other professional public health experts lead those briefings. I think, you know, any American would trust those public health experts. These people are not political. They've served governments of both parties. Both Fauci and Burks have been career public servants. They've served President Bush, for instance, and President Reagan, as well as H.W. Bush, as well as the Democratic presidents. I think that would be far better for the country and better for the president to let the public health experts lead.
All right, I want to go to the phone. We have Dan on the line in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I just wanted to make a contrast between our governor here in Kentucky, Andy Beshear, and President Trump, and how stark a difference you can see in crisis leadership. Governor Beshear has been both comforting and very firm about the steps that we need to take to flatten our curve. And as a result of his leadership, Kentucky is doing way better than a lot of its neighboring states. Whenever things are going wrong, whether it's testing not being done fast enough, things like that, the governor takes full responsibility. And whenever things go right, he spreads the credit around. And he's not been remotely partisan or political with any of this. So the contrast couldn't be greater. And I'm really lucky that we live in the state right now.
Thanks for your call, Dan. Do you want to comment, Ambassador Burns, on the rather tense relationship between the president and a lot of governors? I believe Governor Beshear is a Democrat, but Republican governors as well in some states.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, we're two comments, Chris. Number one is we are seeing really fine leadership from governors and from both parties. Certainly Governor Beshear in Kentucky, Governor Gavin Newsom, I've mentioned him in California, Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York, but Republican governors, Mike DeWine in Ohio, Larry Hogan in Maryland, my own governor, Charlie Baker, he's a Republican. These people have all been kind of straight shooters. They rely on, they're fact-driven, data-driven, I should say. They're not playing politics with it, and I think people really appreciate them for that reason. The second comment would be, the president's made a big point recently in the last couple of weeks of saying, The states are responsible. He tweeted out this morning, those governors better get the testing programs ready. And his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, said, I think infamously 2 weeks ago, these are our ventilators in the federal government. They don't belong to the states. That's exactly wrong about how the American constitutional system was formed. The federal government exists to deliver services to the states, especially in a crisis. The way that we've planned for public health crises is that the federal government would lead and help the states. And frankly, the Trump administration, the president personally, has been trying to have it the other way. You know, I'm in charge, but really it's these governors who are at fault when anything goes wrong. That's not leadership. And that, to me, has been, as a citizen, the most disappointing aspect of the president's so-called leadership.
The president has been clear throughout his tenure in the White House that he is no fan of international organizations, of U.S. obligations to other countries. He has seemingly been uninhibited about expressing his irritation with some traditional U.S. allies. Is there reason to think those frayed relationships are playing a role in a lack of international coordination on COVID-19?
Well, I do think that's one reason why the president is not making an attempt to pull the world together. He doesn't trust a lot of these institutions that you mentioned. And again, he believes the United States truly believes, under America First, his banner, that the United States is better off alone. He couldn't be more wrong about how the 21st century works. I mean, if we're ever going to do anything about climate change, which we must, we have to pull together. And the same is true in a pandemic. And I just say, Chris, I mean, I'll do this very briefly. As you noted, I was ambassador to NATO. I was there on 9/11, serving President Bush and his administration. And when we were hit really hard on 9/11, my phone started to ring. It was all the other NATO ambassadors from the various allied countries. We were all together in Brussels, Belgium, where NATO headquarters is. And they said on the phone, we want to help you. We want to support you. They all went into Afghanistan with us. They're all still there today. And so, you know, we want to have these kind of friends in the world, but if we're disrespectful to them, if all we do is carp about how many dues they're paying and whether or not they always agree with us, then you lose those friends. And here's where we really need friends right now during this pandemic. And so our Republican presidents in the past, I can tell you George W. Bush understood the value of these alliances. Barack Obama understood them. This has not been a partisan issue in the past, but President Trump is making it one. I really think we've got to change gears when it comes to his obsession with acting alone.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You have said that it is not too late for the U.S. to step up and take a prominent global role, starting with forming a steering group of G20 leaders, specifically on the health aspects of COVID-19. What would that look like, ideally? How would it be run? What sort of agenda would that steering group have?
So, you know, the most powerful leaders have a lot of sway in the world, and they have a lot of political influence in the world. And if they got together in the G20, they need to do two things. One is coordinate the global public health response so that everyone's better off on all the issues that we've already talked about, vaccines, testing, tracing and sharing data. But they've also got to get together at the same time and say, how do we avoid a depression? How do we align our monetary policies, our fiscal policies, what we spend together so that we can make sure the world economy refloats when we can all leave our homes and go back to work? That was the brilliance of President Bush in 2008. At the very end of his term, just before the 2008 election, he pulled the world together with the French and others, and they coordinated the response to that economic crisis. Barack Obama did it as soon as he was elected. So we know how to do this. But again, I think it's the political ideology of the president makes him resistant to this. And it's a terrible mistake. I'm hopeful that Republican leaders in the Senate and House can convince him that we've got to have this global response in order to serve the local and state responses here in the United States.
Do we necessarily cede some American autonomy when we participate in a globalized response like that?
Well, it sometimes means you have to compromise, but that's not necessarily always a bad thing. Look, the United States is so powerful in the world today. We chair most of the meetings. We lead most of the parades. We're not giving up a lot. But if it means that, you know, when you do compromise in a big group like that, if it means that our citizens are going to be better off and that people around the world are going to have a better chance to fight the pandemic and survive it, those are real responsibilities that Americans have. All of us as a country when we think about our place in the world.
You note in your essay that the G20 should coordinate private and university vaccine and drug research. Does there need to be an explicit international agreement that any relevant information will be shared with the rest of the world by whichever nation is first to get there?
I think there has to be. You know, no one knows. There's a race now for the vaccine. Interestingly, I teach at Harvard. Harvard University has a research effort on the vaccine with a Chinese university and set of researchers. And so these teams are not solely national. They're international. And whenever the vaccine is discovered and then goes through trials and is found to be safe and effective, you know, theoretically, you're going to need to make that available to everybody in the world. That's 7.7 billion doses. That's a lot of doses. That means, how can we do this at cost? How can we do it so very poor people in very poor countries have as much access to it as any one of us who lives in a wealthy country like the United States? And how can you do it efficiently? And one thought that I've had after listening to Bill Gates, I find him so convincing on this issue because he's both a business person, so he understands that part of it, but he's also a science-oriented person. He's put a lot of his own money and effort into vaccines. If I were advising President Trump, I'd say, make Bill Gates your pandemic coordinator. Make him your international ambassador. Let him help you. Help President Trump organize all this big effort that we're talking about. Presidents past have reached into the private sector. They've reached into university presidents and to former presidents, and they've asked them to take on these big roles. If you remember the Haiti earthquake in 2010, President Obama asked President George W. Bush and President Clinton to work together and to lead the American relief effort, and it was a great page in our history. Why can't we do that now?
My guest is Ambassador Nicholas Burns, Professor of Diplomacy and International Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School. He was also U.S. Ambassador to NATO and Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. He recently had an article in Foreign Affairs magazine titled, How to Lead in a Time of Pandemic. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with Ambassador Nicholas Burns, who was U.S. Ambassador to NATO from 2001 to 2005 and Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 2005 to 2008. Currently, he's Professor of Diplomacy and International Relations at the Harvard Kennedy School and recently wrote a piece for Foreign Affairs called How to Lead in a Time of Pandemic. Ambassador Burns, how might effective or ineffective U.S. action on the world stage position the country for leadership at the conclusion of the crisis? Could a failure to step up permanently diminish America's status in the world?
I think that is a central question that we've all got to be worried about, because our reputation earned during the Second World War and the Cold War and the end of it really was, we're a country that can be counted on, a country that can rise above politics and do the right thing, as we did during the Cold War and defending the democratic world against the communist world. And right now, and I'm sorry to say this because I love our country and want us to succeed, a lot of people around the world look at our administration, especially because the president represents all of us, and say the United States has been selfish to pull out of the climate change accord. We're the only country in the world not in it, the Paris Climate Change Agreement, and we're the second largest carbon emitter. Selfish in the way that we've sometimes competed with the others, other countries, including our democratic allies, for some of this badly needed equipment on the coronavirus, and the lack of leadership of President Trump. And so I do think that's at stake. The Chinese are making, it's a very insincere effort the Chinese are making, but they're making an effort to position themselves as the country that can be relied on. It's the old reputation of the United States. And I certainly don't want our country to be outpointed by China.
You spoke briefly about this earlier. The U.S. should, you think, lead the G20 to create a group that unites finance ministers and monetary policy officials to deal with financial fallout. What has Jerome Powell, Fed chairman in the U.S., been doing on this front?
I think he's been one of the true unsung American leaders. Financial officials and central bank officials have working relations throughout the year. And so Chairman Powell, our chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, has reached out to his Canadian, Japanese, and European colleagues first, and now a wider net of countries around the world. And the Fed has made a lot of money available to banks around the world in swap arrangements to make sure that the global economy, banks can keep lending, and businesses can can continue to survive, and people not everyone has to lose their jobs. And I think that has been a very good model, the Jerome Power model of what the president can do on the political side and the public health side.
Should global leaders reconsider trade barriers that have been erected in the past couple of years?
Yes, because I think what we found from recent economic history, particularly the Great Depression, is that when you're in trouble like this, when you have mass unemployment and economies are tanking and economic activity is plummeting rapidly, that's exactly the wrong time to raise barriers to trade. In fact, we're going to need for the second wave of the pandemic, if it hits, we're going to need a lot more in the way of pharmaceuticals and drugs and N95 masks and protective clothing. And a lot of that is not made in the United States. It's made overseas. So we want this to come inexpensively, quickly, on supply chains that work into the American economy and all around the world. And if you just build walls around the country, that's not going to happen. And again, this is a difference that a lot of us have with President Trump. He's a wall builder. He believes in kind of fencing off the United States from the rest of the world. That's not what made us great. Our economy became a real wonder of the world, and the global economy profited after the Second World War because American governments, presidents of both parties, felt keep barriers to trade low, rely on free trade and the market to work out differences, and you saw this tremendous growth in trade and tremendous growth in wealth where more than a billion people lifted out of poverty in places like China, India, Brazil, sub-Saharan Africa. That didn't happen. It wouldn't have happened if barriers to trade were high and if we'd built walls around all the prosperous countries. And again, I think the president has exactly the wrong policy prescriptions at this very critical moment for the global economy.
A lot has happened in just a month, but many Americans will remember that the president rather abruptly limited travel from Europe. Initially, even U.S. citizens thought they wouldn't be allowed to return home past a certain date. You note that he didn't actually warn EU leaders about the announcement of those travel restrictions until the very last minute. What effect might that have on ongoing U.S.-EU relations?
Yeah, the president was right to cut off travel by Europeans to the United States and right to cut off travel by Chinese to the United States. They've done the same to us, by the way. But what he didn't do was pick up the phone and call Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, or Emmanuel Macron, the President of France, and say, look, I've got to do this. Here's why I'm doing it. I want to alert you so that you're ready. And the result was mass confusion. If you remember the way the president announced it, as you say, Chris, it sounded like he was cutting off all travel by anybody, including American citizens from Europe to the United States. We actually, my wife and I have one of our three daughters lives in Germany. We were worried we wouldn't see her for 6 to 12 months. And that wasn't the announcement of the decision at all. The decision was that Europeans wouldn't be allowed to travel in. At least you owe your counterparts a phone call. And that's the kind of respect that we need to show foreign leaders that pays off. All of our presidents until President Trump have understood this.
What do we need to do for all the people of various nationalities who find themselves stranded outside their own borders by border closures due to the virus?
It's been really difficult. There have been tens of thousands of Americans stranded overseas, and our State Department has been working overtime to try to organize them, sometimes depending where they are, on either from Central America overland trips back into Texas and southern part of the United States, or places further away, special air missions to get people back, humanitarian air flights. But we've had students, we've had tourists, we've had people, as you know, on cruise ships who can't get back to the United States easily because of local decisions in the countries where they were. And I wrote in my foreign affairs article that we've been discussing, I think there hasn't been a time since World War II when so many people have been stranded of all nationalities beyond their home country. And so this is another reason to get countries working together, at least facilitate the travel of our own citizens back and forth so we can get American citizens back home here in the United States.
I've thought even about the money aspects of this. I mean, most middle-class Americans cannot afford to stay in a hotel for a month or 3 months.
Exactly. Very few Americans can afford to do that. Exactly right. That's been one of the real problems. You know, people thought, well, I'm going to go to Paris for a week, mm-hmm. and they ended up spending 6 weeks there. And we've seen this replicated. There have been a large number of American students stranded in Peru, for instance. I received calls from several people, parents and aunts and uncles attached to these people, and that has replicated itself around the world. So, you know, our government, the State Department, I think it's done a good job on this under Secretary Pompeo. I think they've really tried hard to work with other governments, but it's difficult to do this when government after government, it's not just our country, have been shutting down borders to each other.
All right, back to the phones now. Zane is on the line in Austin, Texas. Hi, Zane.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
Ambassador Burns, I have a question for you. During this election year, I'm seeing that it's very problematic that President Trump is really only looking out for himself, putting his children up on the stage, which is very problematic, and not relying on people such as Dr. Fauci and those that really know what to do to get our economy and to get the world back on track. And it's very troublesome to me. Do you see that also occurring during an election year?
Thanks for calling.
Zane, thank you, and I share your concern. I think, you know, the president, as I said to Chris earlier, I think the president has used these press conferences more like campaign rallies. He can't get out and campaign in traditional rallies. People can't congregate. So if you look at these, and I've watched a lot of them, what he's doing is political score settling and talking about his own popularity and the ratings of the briefings themselves, which I think is just wrong to do when we have so many people dying and sick and suffering in the country. One thing that I've thought of, and other people have remarked on this too, we were so fortunate, if you think about our history, that Lincoln was our president during the Civil War. So fortunate that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president during the Second World War. These were leaders who understood how to lead countries with divided politics and unite the nation. And they put the nation first in our two greatest crises. And now we have, you know, arguably the greatest crisis since the Second World War. We have a president who clearly is putting himself first. And I do worry that he's using these press conferences to outgain Joe Biden and to put the Democrats in a corner. And I think it's wrong to use the press conferences like that, because he ought to be talking. He ought to let Dr. Fauci talk and Ambassador Birx talk about the public health angles of this and this whole issue of voting. If we still have the pandemic with us in November, a lot of us who don't currently have voting by mail, some states do, are going to have to vote by mail. But the president's trying now to shut off that possibility, which I think, frankly, is undemocratic.
Do you have the sense, and I recognize that I'm asking you to speculate here, that the president agrees with the experts on the dangers to human lives and the economy at this moment, and is trying to figure out the best way to prevent that damage, or that he disagrees and is not taking the actions you're talking about because he doesn't think they're necessary?
You know, I don't know the president personally, so it's hard to speculate on what's going on in his mind, obviously, and how he approaches decision making. He does not appear, based on the last 3 years, to be someone who is adaptive. So he's got all of his own, you know, he doesn't change much. And I think the smartest leaders in business and government, they change when circumstances change. Or they listen to experts who might be smarter than them on a certain subject. Dr. Anthony Fauci, for instance, on this subject of the pandemic. And if a leader fails to do that, then the leader has a high probability of not making the right decisions for the people. That's what I'm really worried about. And I think the president is signaling that that's where he is. Now, having said all that, he has been dealt a really difficult hand here, because he's going to be the one person who has the most influence on this big issue that's in front of us. And that is, when do we begin letting people go back to church or go back to work? Or reopen kindergarten and reopen the elementary and middle schools, high schools. These are really difficult decisions, because the epidemiologists are telling us if you go back too early, the infection rates are going to spike and people are going to lose their lives. And yet people are really suffering because they've lost their jobs. 17 million Americans have filed for unemployment benefits. We've never had this happen before in the history of the country. So, you know, you got to be sympathetic with the president. At the same time, I'm very critical of how he's done. but I want him to succeed. And this tension between doing the right thing on public on the pandemics, keeping people at home, and then opening up the economy at the right time, that's going to be a very difficult decision for him to make. And I hope he makes it for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons. I hope he makes it based on what's right for people and not what's right for his own popularity ratings.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You note, Ambassador, one final potentially cataclysmic result of the failure to coordinate a robust global response to COVID-19. How serious is the threat of armed conflict in the wake of this pandemic?
We know this is an ancient thing to think about, Chris. If you think about the great plague that happened to Athens during the Peloponnesian Wars against Sparta 2,500 years ago, you think of all the wars that originated from the Black Death in Europe. At times of great upheaval, economic and societal, countries sometimes end up in conflicts they didn't intend to end up in. And so one of the most important things our leaders have to do is stand guard against that, is to make sure you have the lines open to your adversaries. The United States not getting along with China very well these days. Well, that means President Trump should speak to President Xi Jinping twice a month. And our ambassador in Beijing has got to be working with the Chinese every day so that we don't end up in an unintentional conflict that happens so often in recorded history in the wake of these catastrophes that befall people, like the catastrophe. And I think that's what it is that we're experiencing, the pandemic and the economic collapse of our country, at least temporarily, as so many people are hurting out there.
Do we need to be planning now for the next crisis of this magnitude?
Yes. There's no question. I mean, we counted earlier in the program, SARS, H1N1, Ebola, coronavirus. That's four pandemics, big ones, and now the biggest one in 20 years. We're surely going to experience them in the next 10 to 20 years. We must be better prepared. That's why we need to reflect as Americans, how can we be better next time? How can both the individual states and the federal government do a better job for all of the citizens of the United States?
Ambassador Nicholas Byrne served as U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs from 2005 to 2008 and U.S. Ambassador to NATO from 2001 to 2005. Ambassador Burns, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us.
Chris, thanks very much for having me on Think. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter at KERA Think. If you'd like to subscribe to our podcast, just do a search for KERA Think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.